Last week, our Please Explain look at stress was cut short by the unfolding story of the school shooting in Newtown, Connecticut. Many listeners had already called in, and we'd only begun to cover the subject, so we've decided to continue the conversation this week, focusing on how to best cope with stress and how to reduce it in our lives. And joining us again are Dr. Drew Ramsey, Assistant Clinical Professor of Psychiatry at Columbia University's College of Physicians and Surgeons. He's also the co-author of The Happiness Diet, published by Rodin. Dale, and Dr. Rajita Sinha, director of the Yale Stress Center and professor of psychiatry, neurobiology, and child study at Yale University School of Medicine. Welcome back to our show.
Thank you so much.
And we're inviting our listeners to join our conversation. If you have a question about stress and how to cope with it, give us a call at 212-433-9692, or you can write to us on our show page at WNYC.org. Rajita, many people talk about the holidays as being a particularly stressful time. Why any more than other times of the year when we have an awful lot on our plates?
Yeah, it's a really good question, but it's common for people to feel more stressed during the holidays, mainly because you're doing more things. You have more demands on the personal level, family and friends, as well as at work sometimes, wrapping things up before a recess period or a few days off that people can take. And so there's added pressure in managing all of those multiple demands.
So is this something similar to other holidays, Drew, or do you think that because of all of the other things, like even worrying about whether you're getting the right gift for somebody and whether the kids are going to make it to the party on time and things like that, make it even worse?
I think it's worse. I think this holiday season is difficult for people for a couple of reasons. One, we tend to see family a lot, and family can be wonderful. It can also be a source of stress, depending on the dynamics. And then what I'm seeing in my practice is a tremendous amount of difficulty people are having who are mourning, that if you've lost someone, even the last couple of years to for any reason, it makes the holidays tougher because those traditions, ranging from the Christmas morning to a special dinner to going ice skating with your father, if that person has passed on, it makes it very sad, especially as everyone else is so joyous.
Rajita, last week we began by talking about how and why the body reacts to stress the way it does. Can you remind us briefly of what we said?
Sure. We were talking about what happens when we get stressed. The body, the first thing people often will notice is your heart starts to beat faster, or you start to feel aroused. You might get tense. And there is this pressure to do something, what we often will call fight or flight response. If you can get away from the situation, people often feel like they can leave or go into flight, so to speak, or put their defenses up. And the body, there's higher blood pressure, as well as sometimes your attention does get focused. In really high levels of stress, though, people can lose focus and forget what they were, what they needed to get done.
And how much of this is genetically programmed into us as human beings?
We all have what I like to think about stress as is it's an alarming response. We need it for survival. It's very important. But there are genetic differences in how stressed we can get or how high our responses, our physiological responses may get to.
The way that we think about it now is that there are gene-environment interactions, what we call gene-X interactions, where depending on your genetic code, the genetic cards that you were dealt, and depending on the types of traumas or anxiety, anxious experiences that you encounter, that really begins to dictate wiring in the brain over time.
So, but if we are put into stressful situations when we're infants, will be more likely to have problems with stress later?
There's data that certainly suggests that. There are a few kind of target genes that we look at, what are called polymorphisms, different codes that different people get. And what we find is this: a few of these genes that clearly are involved in long-term brain health really dictate long-term responses. And you'll see this also in patients, irrelevant of what their genetic code is. If you have a lot of trauma, that's the basis usually of something like PTSD, one of the major anxiety disorders that we see, that's really triggered by excess and recurrent trauma.
You wanted to add to that, Regina.
Yeah, I was going to say that just to follow up on what Drew was talking about with trauma, you can actually also have high levels of uncontrollable stress that may not meet PTSD criteria, but nonetheless do shape our stress responses in the long term.
But people with PTSD don't always realize it. How do we know when we're feeling too much stress when we've reached a bad level?
We mentioned that a little last week in mental health. We generally look at functioning. We look at how stress interferes with your ability to work. So, for the example, Regina was talking about chronic stresses that might not meet criteria for an illness. What we'll see in clinical practice is someone who just wakes up, for example, and throws up because they're so anxious about going to a toxic work environment. And so they might keep working. And they might, you know, stay in their relationship, but their quality of life is just horrible.
And throwing up is one of the symptoms?
Throwing up can
be an anxiety symptom?
GI upset can certainly be a symptom of anxiety. Something that when you ask, how do we know? A lot of times people don't know because they have physical manifestations. So they'll have high blood pressure or back pain or chest pain. I often get chest pain when I'm anxious. That isn't a serious medical chest pain, but it's related directly to the anxiety.
Regina, is there a connection between the stomach and stress? Throwing up, getting stomach aches, losing our appetite?
There is a very tight and intricate connection between the stomach and being stressed, what we call the brain-gut connection.
Is there a second brain in the gut, as some people have told me?
People have, there is, because of this direct connection, the stomach definitely reacts to things that we are ingesting, as well as keeping tabs and alerting the body and then the brain as well to the response to what we are ingesting. So that's a nice way to put it. People do talk about that. And a lot of the manifestation of being stressed and anxious does come out through our digestive tract. So it's really important to pay attention to those changes that people will feel. You know, there are a couple of common things that people, if you ask them, they'll talk about butterflies in their stomach or feeling a knot in their stomach. That comes up very quickly in a high stress situation, and that's a sign. It's a stress symptom that we like to have folks who come into the Yale Stress Center start to pay attention to.
When we talk about stress, we always talk also about cortisol, which is the major stress hormone or glucocorticoid. And we've mentioned some of this, its effects, such as high blood pressure, but one of them is to increase stomach acid production. And so you'll see that reflux, which a lot of people have, often can be a sign of chronic stress.
My guests are Dr. Drew Ramsey of Columbia, Dr. Regina Sinha of Yale. We're talking about stress on today's Please Explain. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. But people sometimes turn to food and eat more when they're feeling stressed. So if it's upsetting our stomach, why do we go to food?
Well, food generally is a satiating and calming and hedonistic experience. And so a lot of times when people have stress, and particularly the types of stress that Regina's talking about, and you were mentioning, where people aren't really entirely clear why they're upset or clear that they are anxious about a specific thing, food is a kind of panacea often, that you can sit down, you can have a meal, and feel a little more calm, feel more satiated, and sort of settle yourself down. There's also some evidence that eating things like higher carbohydrate meals or sugar can increase the production of some calming hormones and neurotransmitters such as serotonin.
Our phone number here is 212-433-9692, and we're already getting some calls. Ron from Stanford, hi, you're on the air.
Yeah, hi, how are you, Lynn?
Okay.
Hey, the reason
I'm a little stressed out, but otherwise okay.
Hey, the reason I'm calling is, speaking of stress, in my career, I am either 120% or I'm exhausted. That's my life. And I wonder if, you had mentioned food. I eat enough for five people, and I never gain weight.
When you're energized or when you are really feeling exhausted?
I don't eat when I'm exhausted. I eat all the time. People who know me think that I'm a bottomless pit. Mm-hmm. But having said that, it's it's fifth gear or park. And I wonder if that's a symptom. And as an aside, I happen to think that life in the Northeast of the United States is just incredibly stressful. It's just, you know, I know people in Texas, Florida, Oklahoma, California, they don't have, you know, they don't seem to have the pressures that we have.
Well, let's ask Regina about that. Do you think the Northeast is more stressful, or some parts of the country are more stressful than others? I would think that in Texas, where everyone is walking around with a gun, would make me feel more stressful.
Yeah. Well, you know, I think there are parts of the country, and particularly urban areas, people do tend to report greater stress, you know, more farmland, less people in certain parts of the region may invoke a different lifestyle. I think that's really more something to think about and look at, that in urban environments people are often have a different lifestyle and are often doing a lot more and pulled in different directions. Perhaps the nature of the work is different as well in not less urban areas of the country.
I wanted to get back to Ron's question, which is going between park and fifth gear, which I think is a great way to put it. And we see this a lot. Ron, I think you are right in the sense that a lot of people with high-stress careers function in that way. And clinically, when we see this, whether you have an anxiety disorder or not, what I get curious about are all the things that you can't do in fifth gear. It's hard to be in love in fifth gear, except for the first couple of months. It's hard to be a parent in fifth gear. And I think there are health consequences to always being in fifth gear, some of the ones that we've been talking about in terms of chronic stress. So while we all love to be in fifth gear in the sense of we do more and we produce more, I think there is a question of, you know, what would it take for you to be in second or third gear sometimes? Is it some meditation, some yoga, exercise? In my practice is by far my favorite prescription for anxiety because it allows people to get a lot of health benefits, but also just calm down. And so I think that's where we would want to engage with someone who is really going between, you know, polar opposites.
Is exercise similar to meditation in that you're taking time out and doing something that requires, you know, a totally different mindset?
I think they are. I'd love to hear Regina's response to that. I think that exercise is a little different because you also release a lot of endorphins and you stress your body, actually, and you allow your mind to relax.
Regina?
Yeah, I think they're similar in certain ways. They're physiologically different in the sense that exercise is really actually arousing, as we all know, and especially a lot of different types of exercise are highly arousing, whereas yoga and mindfulness are very calming physiologically. But in terms of the mind and what the brain is doing, I think the focus and directing attention to a specific task is a similar component across these two activities, these types of activities. And so the brain can begin to really observe and be in the moment, which is a requirement of mindfulness, and it's a requirement really of exercise too. In many ways, you really are taken up with the activity that you're participating in. And then I agree with Drew that there's release of endorphins and there are release of other kinds of chemicals that we're just learning about in the brain as well as in the body that really do help us achieve a much more relaxed, focused, and calming, peaceful state.
Can you briefly explain what you told us last week about how stress can affect the heart and about white coat hypertension?
Right. So the stress can affect what we call the autonomic nervous system and gets our heart rate and our blood pressure going, and also affect our blood vessels in the long term. So if there's chronic stress, you can start to have too much increases in blood pressure, as well as your blood cholesterol rises. And a good cholesterol drops. And so you can start to have some hardening of arteries and hardening of blood vessels all around. And that can begin to affect the cardiovascular system in a negative way. And this can happen slowly over time. And so it's not just chronic stress levels, but high levels of acute stress up and down can also affect the cardiovascular system.
So, Drew, if we have stress over the long term, there's a good chance or a more likely that we will get a heart attack or have a stroke?
There is, and I think we tend to focus on certain organs like the heart, and I think if we take a step back and you want to look at all cells, because all cells respond to stress. It's not just our heart cells, and all cells show that you have an increase in the production of free radicals, those reactive oxygen species that we try and battle against with antioxidants. You get more of those when you're stressed. We also know that cells age more, and that's not just heart cells, that's all cells. So I'm just as concerned as a psychiatrist, probably more concerned with the effect of chronic stress on brain cells than I am on heart cells. I mean, the stress to heart cells, as Regina's mentioned, you know, are clearly measured and out there. But when you learn that things like chronic cortisol decrease the connections that your brain cells make, that really, I hope, motivates people to decrease their stress and engage in things like we're talking about, some meditation, exercise, or yoga to help them sort of think of your brain as a bit like a muscle. You can build it and be in a different state.
So, a lot of stress actually has an effect on our brains. Our brains age more quickly if we live. There are a lot of people who live in stressful situations. Does that mean if you're in the military or you're a cop or you're an emergency room doctor, you're more likely to have problems later in life?
I would argue yes. I would say that highly stressful jobs, it depends on someone's coping mechanisms. We certainly know of police officers and physicians who have incredible high levels of stress, and they deal with it very, very effectively. We also know of people in those professions who turn to things like to excess drinking is the most common one we see in clinical practice, where people deal with stress through alcohol or through drugs. We see that people have insomnia. They can't sleep because of stress. Some folks deal with that very quickly and effectively, and others go for years.
We're going to take a little break, and when we come back, we'll talk about some of the ways you can cope with stress and look at stress in other situations with children, for example. And, of course, take your calls. Our number here is 212-433-9692. You also can write to us on our show page at WNYC.org. My guests are Dr. Drew Ramsey, Assistant Clinical Professor of Psychiatry at Columbia University's College of Physicians and Surgeons. He is the co-author of The Happiness Diet, and we'll talk about diet in terms of stress as well. And Dr. Rajita Sinha is Director of the Yale Stress Center, Professor of Psychiatry, Neurobiology, and Child Study at Yale University School of Medicine. Stay with us. And we are back with our conversation about stress on today's Please Explain with Dr. Rajita Sinha, Director of the Yale Stress Center, Professor of Psychiatry, Neurobiology, and Child Study at Yale University School of Medicine, and Dr. Drew Ramsey, Assistant Clinical Professor of Psychiatry at Columbia University's College of Physicians and Surgeons. And we are taking your calls at 212-433-9692. Also, looking at your comments to our show page at WNYC.org. And let's address some of the comments that have been coming in. Drew from Williamsburg says, can you ask them, that meaning my two guests, more about the connection between stress and back pain? And is it possible that there's a feedback loop? Stress begets back pain, begets stress until it becomes debilitating. I feel like that's what happens to me until I'm stuck in bed for a month at a time.
The one I see most commonly is people who unconsciously are stressed and shrugging their shoulders. And I see this happen all the time in clinical practice where there's a little muscle that attaches to the back of the shoulder blade and it gets tweaked and it goes into spasm and it causes people incredible pain. And then the other that we see is chronic low back pain, where, again, people are stressed. We're sitting in front of computers for hours working on a deadline and having our body in a position that isn't particularly natural and certainly not natural for hours on end. So that's one of the ways I think that stress and back pain certainly get related.
I can add that in addition, being in pain is stressful as well. Research has been done in looking at the brain connections to our muscles. And the brain circuits that are involved in sensing pain really overlap quite a bit with the stress pathways in the brain. And so your caller's point about the vicious cycle between stress and pain, and then pain causing greater stress, is a really good one, and I'm sure they've noticed it in their own life. And it is one reason why we actually advocate for stress interventions in pain conditions as well.
Let's go to a caller, Janice from Belmar. You're on the air.
Yes, I have been subjected to unremitting and unpredictable stress over the last 8 months in the form of cyber stalking and phone hacking. And I'm really worried about myself. I have a high level, my adrenaline levels are high. I do all of the things that your guests have been talking about, but each time something happens, I get another electroshock. And it happens at unpredictable times during the day. And I, you know, I'm really tearing my hair out. I've lost a lot of weight. I haven't slept well. And I had an endoscopy on Wednesday because of upper GI problems.
Well, so this is something, stress that's caused by somebody else giving her, making her life miserable. Is that, are there ways of dealing with it other than just ignoring the stalking?
I would say that this is a good indication where treatment can be very helpful. We haven't mentioned yet that anxiety disorders are the most commonly mental health diagnosed mental health disorder in America, 40 million Americans. And we have great treatments for how to deal with it. And certainly this is, I'd love to hear Regina's thought, but this is a situation where the locus of control is outside of yourself, and you need to pull that into yourself a little bit more and think about how you could partner with a mental health professional to think about what is possible, and then to understand what's not possible. Sometimes we can't control external factors.
Well, a listener wrote in wondering about the stigma associated with the weakness, quotes, associated with appearing to be stressed or confessing to stress, and that is a problem. That's why some people probably don't seek help.
Right. We should be strong and able to work all day and
stiff
all night, stiff upper lip, never succumb to it, never admit it's too much, and never say no to a task. And I think that's that is out there, but a very unhealthy way to live.
You know, the other thing to point out in addition to that, that we're socially, we propagate being stoic and being able to handle everything. I hope that through these conversations, we can show that stress actually happens a lot in the brain and the body. And being aware of the stress is one component of it. Whether we're aware or not, the brain and the body is going to respond to stress. So it's very much a physiological state as well. And we need to get to that and get past the stigma around it, because it's going to go ahead and affect the body and the brain whether we are aware of it or not.
A lot of listeners are asking about whether there's a relationship between stress and depression.
There certainly is. It's one of the major triggers that we see in depression. And oftentimes, clinically, these two conditions are almost inseparable, that people who have tremendous anxiety do tend to have higher risk rates of depression. And invariably, it affects your mood. We can hear that in the caller. She is feeling down because of anxiety that she has encountered.
Regina, last week we had to discontinue our conversation because of what happened at Newtown. So I wonder if we can talk a bit about stress in children. Do children usually learn to react from stress from others, or is it genetic? Is it influenced by other factors?
As we were talking earlier, it's a gene by environment interaction. So people do have a certain innate abilities in terms of response to stress, but that is very often shaped by their environment and by the role models in children's case around them. We are programmed to learn, and our brains are ready to really start what we call imprinting, the process of imprinting, which is really learning from our environment and the people around us. And so there's a direct interaction between the environment and what's innately wired inside of us. And so you have a lot of different types of children, some who are calm and sit in one place and play, and others who are moving around all the time. And we have to be, as adults around them, have to be flexible cognitively and in our behavioral responses to the children to accommodate these different personalities.
What about teaching children how to cope with stress and how to relax? Can you actually tell them, other than what most parents say, calm down?
Yeah, that's a great point. We have gone through a period, I think, here where we've put a lot of emphasis in talking to children, which is a very important aspect and component. So helping children identify their emotions. You're scared now. You're feeling angry. I need you to sit down. That's really a good way to help children start to identify what's going on. We've not explored as much other aspects, behavioral aspects, as well as showing them. So how do they know to calm down? By showing them. You know, a good teacher often in preschool would sort of say, okay, we're all going to have a quiet time and everybody lies down. And so you're actually pairing the behavioral act of lying down, or perhaps the behavioral act of taking deep breaths, taking 10 counts between breaths. Those are all strategies that we could be showing children, and I think a lot of teachers and parents do that, and that's one way that they learn to good coping skills.
Now, Drew, Aubrey in Carroll Gardens writes, my son seemed to be born stressed as an infant. He was very colicky, always seemed tense. He's 10 now and suffers from acute anxiety. Can a person be born stressed?
For sure. I mean, we see, as Regina was saying, we see, you know, we're all different in how we're wired. I remember one of my professors at Columbia sort of said years ago, you know, I had one kid who's a really happy kid, and then my second one came along, and you just understand temperament, because my second kid is just anxious. And so you certainly see that. I think it's a challenge to parents, and I think in addition to the coping mechanisms that Regina's talking about, I also think that something that is always helpful is to remember that kids love to play, and that is very stress busting, and that, again, there are great treatments out there. People, even though there is stigma, there is nothing worse than having an undiagnosed and untreated disorder.
A couple of listeners have asked about the connection between stress and vitamin deficiencies or diet.
That's certainly something that I spend most of my time thinking about, because we know that most Americans are not eating a healthy diet, and the majority of calories in America come from what are called added fats and added sugars that don't have the essential vitamins that our brains need to optimally function. Something that we see this time of year, for example, is lots of vitamin D deficiency, and while the evidence is still pouring in, it's something that we all note increases stress, increases anxiety. Certainly, it can be a symptom. The one that's most clearly correlated in the data is with choline deficiency, which you can defeat by eating eggs in the morning.
Zoni from Ridgewood, New Jersey, is on the air. Hi.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. I've lately been suffering with anxiety and, you know, the shoulder issue. I've had problems with my shoulder for a while, and I've gone to the doctor, x-rays, and I've gone to my general practitioner, and you know, the recommendation was, okay, do you want Ambience or do you want Xanax? And, you know, so I'm on Xanax, and I tell my, you know, family and friends about it. And the joke is like, oh, well, give me some. But at the same time, I'm suffering with a real anxiety issue here. And I don't know what to do now to address it. Just stay on medication, or, you know, what do you do when you're trying to tell your family and friends you're having a serious condition or a serious, you know, issue happening?
And are people going to be forced to stay on medication all their lives because of they're coping with anxiety?
Well, two notes about that. One, medications in America for the majority of people are voluntary choices. We don't force anyone to stay on medicine unless they're dangerous. And secondly, we should note, as much as there's stigma, 12% of American adults, 12% take antidepressants, which are the medicines we use not just for depression, but we also use them for anxiety. And so for the caller, what I would recommend, and I think something that you're picking up on, is that you're not treating the cause of the anxiety. You're treating the symptom, and that's what Xanax and Ambien will do. I would not think that those are good long-term solutions for you, and so that's where you would want to think about some other alternative therapies, such as the main therapy with evidence behind it for anxiety is a type of psychotherapy or talk therapy called cognitive behavioral therapy. It's usually a skills-based, short-term psychotherapy where you can learn to sort of, just like a workout builds your muscles, you can learn to use your mind, use your cognitive thoughts to overcome some of the anxious feelings that you're having.
Now, Regina, therapy dogs have been brought into Newtown. Can you explain how animals help people cope with stress and grief?
Sure. There is growing evidence that our stress pathways and our stress arousal systems can calm down with a number of different types of strategies. Talk therapy is one, but social support through touching, nonverbal ways, finding things that are calming, like fur of dogs, having a cuddly, warm being, living being with you that is not talking but is providing comfort is a very important way of decreasing the stress arousal state.
I have a therapy dog in my office, Leonard, and I'm amazed at how much patients both attach to him, but also just enjoy his presence. They'll either put his head in their lap, or you know, they'll pet him, especially when they're very upset. And we call it animal-assisted therapy, where you have this very benign and loving creature there, and dogs tend to be happy and interested and curious. And I think it's great that they've brought in therapy dogs into Newton.
We have very little time. Many people self-medicate by using alcohol or drugs. Some of our listeners have suggested acupuncture, massage therapy.
Those are great alternative treatments. You know, in medicine, we always want there to be lots of evidence, and there's not lots of evidence about any of those. But I can tell you those are both treatments that I personally use on a regular basis because I find them to be very helpful and very calming.
What about a glass of wine? You know, just one glass of wine.
Yeah. How many people do you know that just have one glass of wine? I mean, I think that I think you know, one glass of wine certainly is something that can help calm people down at the end of the day. But what I find is that often people have a hard time stopping with one, and then you know you end up having two or maybe three, and then not feeling so well the next day, and the next day goes worse. So it shouldn't be at the top of your list of things to fight anxiety.
We have no time left, but if somebody has a panic attack, just go to the hospital?
If someone has a legitimate panic attack, I don't think you necessarily need to go to the emergency room, although you can, but I think you'd want to reach out to some of the great centers like the Yale Stress Center at Regina and at Columbia and New York State Psychiatric Institute. We have a wonderful center for the treatment of anxiety
disorders.
Although
if you live in Texas, you don't have to worry about that. My great thanks to both of you for participating again in our look at stress on our Please Explain segment. Dr. Drew Ramsey, Assistant Clinical Professor of Psychiatry at Columbia University's College of Physicians and Surgeons and co-author of The Happiness Diet, which is published by Rodale, and Dr. Regina Sinha, Director of the Yale Stress Center and Professor of Psychiatry, Neurobiology, and Child Study at Yale University School of Medicine. Thank you both so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.